Welcome to Everyone Deserves Sunshine. I'm Diana.
And I'm Anusha. We're the girls in the crease.
Anusha, so I realized this past week that I have even less self-control than I thought I had, which is already very little. I swore to myself and to everyone else that I will not read any of the books.
I remember.
I didn't want to spoil it for myself for season two. But then what had happened was I kept seeing spoilers on Threads and on Insta. And at some point I was like, okay, well, it's either going to get spoiled by other people or I can read it myself.
They are very good books.
Oh my God, they are so good. So right? I have already read Heated Rivalry, Game Changers, and Role Models. Somebody said you have to read Role Models first because they intersect a lot. So I finished all of those books, each book per day, because I couldn't stop. But now that I am here with The Long Game, my best friend and I are reading it together, and we have decided we will savor every single word, every single period, because we don't want it to ever end. And so we have set a limit to 3 chapters a day, which is honestly killing me, because I'll read the 3 chapters and I'm like addicted. I'm like jonesing for it all day long. And I'm also like terrified to get heartbroken. So I'm taking it really slowly, but I'm already heartbroken.
First of all, I'm so excited for you that you're reading the books. Second, I also am reading everything entirely out of order. So I understand the first way you're reading books, but my God, the way you're describing reading The Long Game is like completely impossible for me to understand, because once I start a book, I can't stop until it's done. I have to tell you a little story. So one of my dear college friends would like read a few chapters a day or write a few pages of her senior thesis a day. And I was so jealous because I would watch her work and it was like watching an alien, because I was not able to have that degree of self-discipline at all. So that is not how I work. That is not how I read. That has a lot to do with my ADHD.
Wow, that was a really good setup for our show, Anusha.
I do try.
All right, you do. You really are great at this. Okay, everyone, this is episode 4, Girls in the Crease Talk About Neurodivergence. Before we get started, I do want to make it really clear what we're doing here. We're not armchair diagnosing. The writers, the actors, the director all confirm that Shane is neurodivergent. Hmm. What we're talking about today is the coding in the show and how neurodivergence shows up in behavior, pacing, communications, and relationships. For a lot of viewers with autism, this wasn't like a reveal. And I've seen a lot of commentary about it online. So we're not sitting here doing a diagnostic checklist, but, you know,
not doing that.
Right. We're not doing that. And like Rachel Reed has talked about it pretty openly. She said that when she wrote Heated Rivalry, she wasn't really consciously thinking like, oh, OK, I'm writing this like autistic character. But then later, after going through the long and complicated process of getting her oldest son diagnosis, she looked back and realized like, oh, yeah, like Shane is probably autistic, because she was writing him as what she knew. Right. In her own son. And then Hudson Williams said his actual real life dad is on the spectrum. He talks about his dad's like sensitivities and how connected he feels to him and how that has informed his own performance as Shane. When Hudson Williams was looking at the script, he like immediately saw what he needed to do, and he empathized with the characters because of his own dad.
Yeah. I did read that about Hudson's father being on the spectrum. So Hudson has said he has ADHD. And I think this sort of ADHD wiring, it comes with, I call it pattern recognition on steroids. And a lot of it, at least in sort of my experience of having ADHD, is this intuitive understanding of social and emotional patterns, reading people. Mm-hmm. And I can see how, combined with Hudson's experiences being with his dad, how that would help Hudson bring Shane, who has been described as sort of a very internal character, to life. And I also want to add that I love that you said your caveat about not an armchair diagnosis in the beginning. I wanted to add something else to that, because Shane's portrayal is one experience of autism. He's verbal. He's a high performer. He has support systems. He can mask when it's needed. But this is not the only autistic experience. There are autistic people who have higher support needs, whose experiences aren't shown in the show. And I don't want to erase that reality. As a neurodivergent person myself, and as a pediatrician, to me, saying that is really important. But I also think it's okay to discuss this flavor of neurodivergence, what it does well, what it means to us, and still give space to that fact that this isn't encompassing of the entire autistic spectrum. And that's okay. That's okay. I just wanted to acknowledge that, though.
You're right. And like, this portrayal is not meant to stand in for all autism, obviously, right? Yeah. But it is meaningful that we're finally seeing an autistic character who is competent, desired, emotionally deep, right? And not like framed as a problem that needs to be solved or a lesson to be learned.
Tell me, Diana, when did it occur to you that Shane was autistic? Was there like a moment?
You know, it's interesting because people we're friends with, they know that we're doing this episode on neurodivergence. So many of them were like, but is he autistic? And so a lot of people didn't actually notice that he was autistic because they're like, well, is he actually autistic? Or are you guys like diagnosing him yourselves? You know, I have many, many, many neurodivergent people in my life as a teacher too. Like, I am very quickly to pick up on these things. But with Shane, I immediately, the very first moment where he and Ilya are going to have their very first sexual encounter, and Shane very neatly folds his clothes. Now, listen, when you're having like a hot sexual event happen,
and you're first,
you're first, and it's like so hot, and it already had started, right? They already made out. He already gave him a blowjob, right? So they're in the middle of it, and this boy like takes his pants and like neatly folds them over the couch, and like you could see Ilya like look at him and smile. And to me, like that scene right there was like, oh baby, I felt the same way as Ilya. Like, look at this boy, like he's so sweet, like look at how he folds his clothes. At that point, I was like, maybe, like, because again, like we're not used to seeing it like presented so gently, right? Like, and so, and I'm like, no, it's just me being a teacher. And then I'm like, wait a second, when he can't sleep in his hotel room in the very beginning, and he goes to the gym in the evening, he makes his bed too. I saw that, and then it kept getting reinforced. I'm like, all right, I'm not nuts. I understand what's happening here. It's very subtle. It's very lovely, but it is there. It's definitely present. And also, now that I've, as everybody knows, I'm reading the books, and I'm not giving anything away, but in the books, it's even more obvious that he's definitely neurodivergent.
So interesting that you said that moment, because I think one of the things about Jacob Tierney and Hudson and all the people involved, and Rachel Reed was a producer too on the show, is that you realize how intentional each direction is. You know what I mean? Like, you go back and you're like, they didn't accidentally put in that folding of pants scene. So I can see how that moment clicked something in your head. For me, because I watched this in like the depth of night under my blankets, and I watched so many episodes in a row and like a complete vacuum, I think it was like the overall gestalt after seeing Shane on the screen for a while. I feel like I was in the middle before I knew it began, which, by the way, is a quote from Pride and Prejudice. Of course I would connect Mr. Darcy and Shane Hollander. But in retrospect, I will say that the show actually like very much sets the stage for this early in episode one. So when that hockey announcer says he may not be the most sociable, but this is the kid with the highest hockey IQ out there.
Clocked.
You're like, boom, there it is.
Boom.
set up, right? I feel like that line does so much work because it establishes that Shane processes the world differently. He strategizes the game differently. And that's meant to be brilliant. Like, that's what gives him his competitive edge. In that same line says the social stuff is harder. Yes. And I think that that thread of the hockey obsession sort of goes the entire way through the series and the books, because Shane reads only hockey books. You know, it's the hockey books on his nightstand. He reads nothing else. He has this deep special interest that becomes an expertise. Yeah, that's a pretty classic autistic trait.
Pretty classic. I know. When I went back for my second rewatch, and I heard that line again, I'm like, you were right here the whole time.
You know, like, right.
You were here, you know? And like, as you start noticing it, you see it everywhere. Mm-hmm. Their first, you know, encounter, Ilya comes in and he's like, I thought you were going to chicken out. And Shane is like, I'm not a chicken. So literal, you know? When he's doing the interview in French, right? Mr. Uh-huh, Perfect uh-huh, in
Mr.
French.
Perfect.
Yeah. And then the reporter asks him, you're being compared to Serena Williams and Tiger Woods. Do you agree with that or whatever? And he's like, I don't think about stuff like that. And like,
I remember
he
that.
Doesn't. And he's not being humble. It's just not how his brain works. Like, he doesn't think about stuff like that, right? Yeah. His communication is explicit, literal, and precise. And this is where I really want to pause, because that seems to get misunderstood often, but literalism is not lack of intelligence or lack of emotional depth. It's just a different processing style. He's actually just taking people at their word and
very much face value.
Yeah.
You
know,
what you see is what you get. Okay, can I add another hilarious moment to this list of moments we're collecting? So in episode 4, when Hayden tells Shane his wife Jackie is pregnant with their fourth child, and Shane just in complete disbelief goes, again? And Hayden is like, holy shit, dude, you have to work on your lying. Shane does not have that capacity to, you know, lie, especially when it comes to these like off the cuff moments. Right. And it's so hilarious because it's so honest. He's not trying to be rude. There's no malice in it. Mm-hmm. I feel like in the hands of someone else, it could be read as judgmental. But with Shane, it's just the sort of the earnestness you describe, you know, just taking everyone at what they say, face value. And one of the things I also loved about that scene is it gives you a glimpse into Hayden and Shane's friendship, because Hayden laughs. He's not offended at all, and he kind of loves him for it. He knows Shane at this point, even when it's awkward, maybe especially when it's awkward. Mm-hmm. It's endearing to him. And I loved that friendship development between someone who is coded as being autistic and the relationships. I think the show did that really well. But that moment really struck me.
I think it's such a beautiful moment between those two friends. Right. And there's so many other ways that the show depicts Shane's neurodivergence without announcing it. Mm. He doesn't get flirting much unless it's like very explicit. He takes jokes literally. He does ask clarifying questions often instead of trying to infer what's going on. Because he realizes like, he needs certain structure and certain, needs met for him to truly understand. And listen, he follows instructions exactly the way they are from the get on your knees.
Oh, my God. and then he just drops.
Just drops. Totally drops to you make 8 burgers and this is the recipe. So you're going to make exactly 8 burgers.
Why don't you cut it in half?
And that, like, that follows instructions piece is, like, so important. It's safety. Like, you know, the precision is calming, right? Ambiguity for him is, like, distressful. Like, he doesn't like it. It makes him feel uncomfortable.
Yeah. And also the instructions are meant to be, like, they're meant to be. They're instructions. You're supposed to follow them. You know, it's, like, not just calming. It's also kind of his
baseline. That's what you do.
That's
what you do. I mean, to be honest, I also make recipes like this. I will follow the instructions to a T. I don't know how to double it. I don't know how to half it. But I think that's my math problem more than anything.
Same here. I'm not going to blame that one on my neurodivergence. That's a math issue.
That's a math issue. But for Shane, it's not. I have a feeling he's very good at math, you know, because he's so smart. But anyway, what we're talking about is coding, right? The show is depicting sensory overload, flat affect, processing time, masking anxiety. And what makes Shane's neurodivergence feel so real is that none of it's announced. It's just embedded into everything he does, because that's how it is in real life.
Yeah.
And so his on-screen presence is handled with so much care and so much love. Like, we don't usually see neurodivergent characters like that. And he's just like allowed to be Shane, not Shane with autism. Mm-hmm. Even Shane doesn't know that.
Absolutely. And I agree with you 100% that the show portrays Shane with like such nuance. I mean, I think the listeners are going to be tired of hearing the word nuance, but I mean,
we use it all the time.
We say it all the time.
It's a great word,
it's
though. It's a very pretty word. Rolls off your tongue quite nicely.
It does. And it's so perfect for the show, because sometimes I feel like you get this trope of a weird genius or sort of deficit based, right? That's what you get. And this one is not pathologizing. I think what you're saying, it's just very humanizing, you know, just like a human experience. And like you said in the beginning, this professional lens that we have, it's really hard to take off. But I'm trying to undo some of that for myself. So let's talk about how this very clinical way facial expression is sometimes talked about in autistic folks, right? Sometimes it's called like a blunted affect or restricted affect. And it's really a clinical phrase because neurodivergence was a medical pathology not that long ago, right?
Right.
And now we're talking about it as a variation on existence, really, at least in some ways. I'm not minimizing support needs, et cetera. But again, it's like this like very clinical way of looking at someone. I feel like it frames it as though emotional expressiveness is missing. But my husband is autistic and he gave me permission to sort of share this aspect of him because it just informs so much of our mutual existence together. Right. When people converse, their face is sort of like part of that social communication. It's almost like a billboard. Or you're nodding, you're smiling, you're moving your head, you're talking with your hands, which I'm doing right now. But my husband says that when he is talking to someone else, it takes focus and energy and processing resources to understand the complexity of these social interactions. It takes him actual energy. And I don't notice that, you know, for myself. And so he has this sometimes socially neutral face. And that's especially true when I'm radiating emotion, like when I'm hopped up and hyped up.
He like regulates himself because you're so up there. Right?
Yeah. And he's trying to actually think about what I'm feeling during these moments. His face becomes neutral is what I was thinking of calling it. But it's not the reduced capacity of emotions because both my husband and Shane, you can see they're just such deeply feeling people. It's just that when you add the social piece, there's all this background noise, the eye contact, the expectation, the subtext that we non-autistic people doesn't even occur to us that these things are happening. It's just part of sort of our baseline. So it's just been really fascinating, complicated to learn all this in real life. And I think seeing it on the show, it meant a lot to me. Hudson has this thing he said about Shane, about the scene in the cottage on the couch where they're talking about the future. And
when he wants to kill Ilya, when Ilya says, could marry Svetlana. And Shane's like, I could murder you right now in this cottage. No one knows you're here.
Exactly. That scene. And we've talked about this sort of like how Shane almost wells up his eyes with tears, but the tears don't fall.
Glorious acting.
How does that happen? Hudson said that was a specific acting choice. He said Shane's tears aren't really falling. They're just welling up. It almost feels like Shane has this notion that if you let the tears fall, now you're crying. But if you don't let them fall.
My stomach hurts just thinking about
that. Oh, so beautiful. But if you let them fall, Jacob Tierney said something like, Shane does not know how expressive he is. He just doesn't. It's like he thinks he's masking better than he actually is.
You know? Because he can't see his own face.
He can't. And he's just so deeply feeling. At the end of the day, Shane is just beautifully varied in his expressiveness based on the context. In that context, it was just Ilya, the cottage. He was deeply safe. And I feel like the fact that Jacob and Hudson really got that is just unbelievable. It's like a chef's kiss.
It is.
Such sophisticated an authentic and gentle representation.
I love that you used the word sophisticated because that's literally what it is. Yeah. Like, it is so sophisticated. It's so beautiful. It's so well done. Shane is, you can read all the emotions in his face most of the time. You really can. And that's beautiful. And episode 5 is such a good example of that because he feels so deeply without broadcasting it in the way that we're used to seeing on TV, right? Also the part where he comes out to Rose and he's so emotionally controlled, right? Yet you could see that he's feeling so much at that point. Like, and there's also this internal shift for him. He hits a tipping point and he acts, right? And while he doesn't emote expansively, he just makes precise, decisive moves with his facial expressions and his eyes and like tears, same thing in that moment. The tears don't quite fall, right? And it's not coldness. You can never say he's cold. That moment, he kind of understands he can't hide anymore. Yeah. He's being explicitly asked, are you gay? And the funny thing is, like, she tries to go about it in a different way, right? In the very beginning. She's like, so did you notice that Miles is gay? And then she goes, you know what? I think I'm going about this the wrong way. And she immediately goes, okay, you know what?
This is not working.
This is not working. I need to be a little bit more explicit with this man.
This show makes it very easy for us to have, like, brilliant insights. It's really great.
Well, I mean, you know, it's just a brilliant show. So yeah, it's really easy to talk about it in the context of really anything. The themes!
The themes!
I love reading other people's thoughts, not just my own, obviously. And it was this man, David Samuel Levinson. And he said, for a lot of us who grew up different, that wasn't part of the norm. I think heated rivalry hits us much more deeply because the whole show is about being seen, and not just being seen, but being accepted, not just being tolerated, but being accepted for who you are. That's the power of the show. And so someone shared that within their own context and basically talked about how autistic viewers feel about the show and why they react so strongly, not because the show told them something new, but because it trusted them to recognize themselves in it. Yeah. You know, shows and movies tend to reduce neurodivergent characters to cliches, right? And make it the entire personality of that specific character. But Shane is just himself. He has anxiety. He's a little socially awkward. People have to literally beg him to hang out with him. That is refreshing. And I also think it's really refreshing to see this intersection between masculinity to this neurodivergent coding, right?
Okay, tell me what you mean.
Right. So Shane's neurodivergent traits are not softened to make him more palatable. He's still desired. He's respected, right? He's emotionally steady, and he's pretty sexually confident in his own way. Maybe not the way others think it is, but he is, right? The fact that he literally, first time he meets Ilya for an encounter, gets down on his knees immediately, that's got to be some confidence right there, because, like, you know, he doesn't know, he doesn't he's never done it, and he doesn't perform masculinity because he can't, he doesn't know how anything. He can't perform much, but he's still chosen, and I love that.
That's everything.
That's a really
help
good
me.
Point. You don't want to ever leave. You never want to leave.
I don't.
So
you
don't
need
any
help.
I'm very happy
here.
Yeah. I actually really, really, really love that you said that, because I feel like sometimes when you're coded in an autistic way or neurodivergent way, it's sort of like it becomes like you're not as masculine, you know? And this does not do that at all. It just presents different ways. I totally agree with that. And here's one other really interesting thing that the show does. It never actually says Shane is autistic. And I just really, really feel like that works, because there's this thread in the whole show that sometimes you don't need that categorical vocabulary to present your experience. Here's what I mean by that. When Ilya says, I'm not gay, not completely, he's not using sort of categorical language. He's just kind of telling you what he feels like his life experiences. And then when Shane comes out to his parents and his dad's like, well, Ilya, I thought you were a bit of a ladies' man. And Shane tells his parents that Ilya likes both, as in both men and women. And sort of people are just who they are. I'm not saying that explicit naming doesn't matter. It totally does. Representation matters. Kids who are autistic, seeing a character named as autistic, as being loved and successful and all the things Shane is, it matters. It matters. Right. But for this particular show, the coding doesn't feel like hiding. You know what I mean? To me, it feels like trust. It feels like they're showing the viewers who exactly Shane is and trusting the audience to meet them there. That's why we're all talking about the neurodivergence in Heated Rivalry. And that's because even though it's not explicitly stated, Jacob Tierney and Hudson chose this one path and they executed it just beautifully. Just beautifully.
Yeah, I agree. You're saying how, like, you know, the show, the creators are trusting the audience to, like, meet Shane where he's at, right? And, like, I think that I often think about, you know, in my career as a teacher, how when kids come into my classroom, I have to be able to also look for things to make sure that I am giving my kids the services that they need and deserve. Mm. But schools are basically a lab for masking, right? Sometimes kids are labeled rude, but they're actually overloaded. Kids sometimes are labeled that they don't care, but they actually just have processing lag or flat affect, right? Kids will get called control freaks, but like they're just self-regulating. They thrive in routine. And then the bright, compliant kids get missed because they're functional until they're not. You know,
until they're not.
And that maps perfectly into Shane. He's elite. He knows what he's doing. Highest IQ, right? Like that's his own reward system. But no one asks him what it costs him, you know? And so his functioning doesn't mean he's thriving. Early in my teaching career, I didn't get some of that. So I was probably someone who was like, oh my God, this kid's being rude or doesn't care about what we're doing. But then like with experience, I started to realize like, oh, like, no, like I need to look at every kid in their own way. To make sure that I give them like meet them where they are at. They can't meet me. I'm the adult in the room. And Ilya does that for Shane, actually, often.
Ilya definitely does that.
He meets Shane where he is often. You could see Ilya switch a lot of the times where he's joking around with Shane or asking him questions or saying things to him. And he realizes Shane isn't processing exactly how Ilya means for it to be processed. Then Ilya will accommodate and modify his behavior and his language to meet Shane where Shane is.
Oh, that's so beautiful. I definitely think that relieves some of that masking and social anxiety. Because if you think about it, kids like Shane or those kids in your class, they're accommodating all the time, whether or not you have needs. Like kids are always accommodating to adults. Add on top of this neurodivergence, those kids are accommodating every single moment. You know, I can see how tiring that can be, how much social anxiety that would give you. I definitely relate to this conversation about masking, especially as thinking back as like a young girl with ADHD. First of all, back then, saying back then makes me sound like so ancient.
I mean, we're not that young anymore. So I think we can use back then.
Back then. Neurodivergence was not on people's radar the way it is now, especially if you didn't present in this classical way. Like for ADHD, you know, it's that boy who can't sit still, who's bouncing off the walls, who's interrupting, etc. And I was none of those things. I was very self-contained. I sat nicely at my desk. And from the outside, I looked like the perfect student. But inside, I was just complete mess. Even as a child, I just remember feeling this sense of being a total imposter. Even before I knew the phrase imposter syndrome, I felt like I was one glitch away from collapse. Always.
Oh, and baby.
I
want to hug you right now.
It's true. It did, and it got worse as I was getting older, because then I didn't have parental scaffolding that kids have. Right. And I was supposed to become more independent over my work. And on top of that, I actually had some real weaknesses in my learning profile. As you know, Diana, I'm a really bad speller. So like my parents are Indian and they're Indians are obsessed with spelling bees. It's like a thing. And my parents would enter me in so many spelling bees outside of the school ones. And I would be out in the first round.
But they kept going.
It was so mortifying. I mean, I couldn't understand because I felt like I could write and I was articulate with my ideas, but spelling, it was such a disaster. But now I know it's part of like the sequencing aspect that I have trouble with, the working memory.
Oh man,
thing.
Now I can't make fun of you for it. That's messed up.
I'm still gonna do it. You're gonna do it despite my neurodivergence. And I can't even begin to tell you how much of a character flaw it felt like to have this ADHD style of procrastination. But it's actually not procrastination. It's like task paralysis. That's what it's called. It's wanting to do the thing, knowing I need to do the thing, still being completely unable to start it, ruminating miserably about not doing the thing for hours. And I am in agony. My brain just can't like get itself to release the dopamine it needs to start this process until it gets to like the 11th hour. And you have been in the receiving end of this too at times.
Have.
And now that I know that's classic executive dysfunction and it's become even more difficult because as a mom, executive functioning is like what moms are supposed to do.
Yeah.
And when I talk to my fellow moms about this and everyone, they're like, I'm the brain of the house. And I nod my head and I feel like a complete imposter. It's like you move forward in life with some combination of whatever your inherent intelligence is, your hyper focus, but there's this like enormous compensatory effort that's completely invisible. That's the masking.
Right.
You asked the question, Shane is surviving, but what's the cost?
Mm-hmm.
And that invisible struggle. And it hits me really hard because that constant I'm a failure dialogue that runs through your head as a child, it messes with your self-esteem like no other. It's like that gap between how others perceive you and how you experience what you do inside. That struggle, that way in which Shane is portrayed on screen, it hit me so hard, like just seeing that.
I thought I was going to cry during the immigrant episode, but here we are.
I know you are. Why are you crying? Tell me.
Makes me think about some of my students. I used to teach 11th and 12th grade, so I would have an 11th grader and I would have them again as seniors. Uh-huh. And, you know, you could see how kids who especially are undiagnosed, how much they struggle and how much internal shame they have over that. And all I think to myself, even though I will accommodate and oftentimes I will fight for accommodations for them, I still feel so deeply sad about the fact that they've gone through their entire educational career without having all these accommodations and they've come to believe that they are stupid and they're not intelligent and they're not good enough. And then all they really, really needed was some sort of an accommodation from the very beginning. That has always broken my heart. But like, as you're talking about it, you could see that I have tears in my eyes because we need to do such a better job with that. Okay, I'm done. I can't go on. No. Let's move on to the next thing. Let's talk about something else. All right.
Yeah. No, I think it's true. It's not just the accommodation. It's that understanding and the acceptance. And and here's the key part. It's like they need to learn about how to learn. They need to learn to work with their neurodivergence and not against it. And that's a years long process. But the first step in that is really feeling that these elements of your core self aren't some sort of character flaw.
Mm-hmm.
Kudos for you for recognizing and, you know, fighting for your kids when they needed something. I remember every teacher who leaned into my way of thinking and working. So that carries forward. So everyone who did see me, I always was really grateful for.
I see you.
So Diana, can I tell you a story?
Anytime,
girl. Always. I say.
Isn't that what we do here?
That's what we do. That's the entire premise. So as you know, we live in a neurodivergent household. And I just want to tell you this interpersonal relationship thing that me and my husband had. I was diagnosed with ADHD formally not very long ago as an adult. And as part of the diagnosis, you know, the psychiatrist gave me a questionnaire to give to someone who knows me well, and they would fill it out. And of course, I gave it to my husband, and I told him,
should have given it to me.
Yeah.
Girl. You'd get all sorts of diagnoses.
I know, exactly. So I told him to fill it out with honesty. And also, don't worry, I'm not going to read it. And so he did.
And he does honesty very well.
He's very, very honest. And he filled it out. He left it in his office. And I came into his office when he wasn't there. I was clearly looking for this form.
Oh, my God. Even though you said you weren't going to read it.
And it was sitting in plain sight on his desk. Completely unhidden. Of course I'm looking. Of course I'm going to look. And I looked and oh my God, it was not flattering at all. It was my God, I read this.
I mean, you have someone with autism, to be honest. I don't know what you expected.
Yes. Yes. It was unbridled autistic honesty. And I was so mad at him. And I said, is this what you think of me holding this paper? And he's like, what are you doing with that? You said you weren't going to look. And a part of me was like, I am definitely going to get that ADHD diagnosis. Like, definitely, definitely going to get it. So the intent has been accomplished. But my husband could not get past. You said you weren't going to look. And
I mean,
that's a fair thing to not get past, to be honest.
But he has known me for this long. Has anything ever given you the impression that I would stick to this in our life? And that's like such a neurodivergence.
But listen, you're still neurodivergence,
and we're together, and I got my diagnosis. So it's a win-win-win.
Well, I love that story. 100%. But this leads very nicely into our next thing about interpersonal relationships. I want to talk about the relationship between Shane and Ilya, obviously, because what else is this for? And I did bring this up earlier, but I want to kind of like do a little bit more of a deep dive. When you look at their relationship through the neurodivergent lens, like you could see that Ilya is genuinely like charmed by Shane's quote unquote quirks, right? Mm. The folded clothes, the earnest text, the logistics, the literalness. Mm-hmm. But more than that, he also clocks like Shane's needs and responds to those needs with care. Okay. Mm-hmm. And I know that we've talked about Ilya being an asshole. He like teases him and plays with him. But like, I think yes, but also
that's his personality.
That's his personality.
Bit.
Correct. And then, but he also adjusts, right? When Shane panics, Ilya doesn't escalate. He helps regulate him. At the cottage, when Shane's dad discovers him, right? Ilya grounds him instead of also being dramatic, right?
He literally grounds him.
He hugs him really tight. Shane is like, this is my literal nightmare. Ilya, this is my nightmare. And Ilya delivers one of the best lines is maybe it's time to wake up. Yes.
Such
like, oh, I want that tattooed. And I've seen people getting tattoos of that.
Yes.
So over time, Ilya learns how to read all of Shane's micro impressions to notice when there's a shift in his expressions and to adjust in real time. You can see it when he jokes early on after their first sexual encounter together. They have this like awesome time and Shane is so excited. It's so good. And then you could see his face changes and he's like, you're not going to tell anyone. He gets really upset. And Ilya doesn't quite understand, like he can't joke around, especially at a time like this. So he does make a joke at first. He's like, no shit. He says it in Russian, like, неужели. But what he means to say is like, no shit. Like, obviously, I'm not going to tell anyone. But Shane does not, he does not accept that.
Yeah.
So he like shifts uncomfortably. He's completely serious. And he says, because no one can know. And Ilya immediately realizes, like, I can't be sarcastic right now. So he says, I'm not going to tell anyone. So he like learns that Shane does best with explicit, clear communication. Mm-hmm. And the second time they meet, when they're trying to decide where they're going to meet again next time to actually have sex for the first time. And so Ilya's like, okay, well, we'll see each other next time. And Shane's like, next time. And he's like, yeah, well, we're playing in Montreal in 2 weeks. And Shane starts struggling. And Ilya's like, we'll meet at your house. And Shane's like, again, very literally, it's an apartment. Like,
oh my
Ilya
God,
sees that he starts to spiral. Mm. He immediately de-escalates with clarity instead of subtext. He goes, it's just a plan to fuck. Mm-hmm. It definitely regulates and de-escalates Shane in that moment. And the moments people read is like super funny, right? Like Shane earnestly answering how many times he can come in an hour, right? Like noticing that the bed is all dirty for the first time,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
The teeny tiny like teary smile when Ilya wins the cup. Like the quote, being boring is genetic jokes,
right?
Like Shane, like, followed by, like, these sincere, like, really? Like, none of these are jokes. None of these are jokes at Shane's expense. Ilya does not joke at Shane's expense.
No.
He's not. When he calls Shane boring all the time, like, that word does a lot of work in their relationship. For Ilya, boring doesn't mean, like, dull or uninteresting. It means safe, predictable, like, grounding, right? These moments aren't supposed to be punchlines. They're just windows in how Shane experiences the world. And what Ilya does so beautifully is meet him there, translate the world into something Shane can actually stand inside without flinching or feeling uncomfortable or feeling like he can't be himself. And I think that's genius. I really do.
Yes to all of that. And I think one of the things, words you used is like charmed. I think Shane really disarms Ilya. It flips the script because society often frames neurodivergence as the thing that is being accommodated. But the show and the books make it clear that Shane gives a lot to Ilya. Mm-hmm. Shane gives Ilya certainty because he doesn't do any games. He has no subtext.
Right.
You know, and I can imagine for Ilya in a foreign land, navigating all these like customs that are new and unspoken, that must feel so refreshing. He approaches Ilya with curiosity and not judgment. And I think sometimes that curiosity is waved away from Ilya because he sees it for what it is, which is an interest. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe I'm too into you, as Shane mm-hmm. says. And sometimes as the audience, you know, we talked a little bit about that in the last episode. We're like, why are you asking this extremely obvious question, Shane? Mm-hmm. I'm thinking about where Shane asks about Ilya's feelings about Russia and his yeah. family in Russia. At first glance, you're like, read the room. But, yeah. you know, the thing is, Shane can't actually read the room like right. that. He's asking because he's genuinely curious and right. wants to know about Ilya from the beginning. And he yeah. wants it from Ilya about Ilya. So I feel like when we talk about accommodations in this relationship, the show and the books make it really clear it's not one directional. Mm-hmm. It's not just Shane receiving understanding. He's providing something equally.
He is.
He's providing safety, clarity. He's providing the space for Ilya to just be himself.
Yep, absolutely. And like Shane also learns, because toward the end in the cottage, when he asks Ilya, have you talked to your family? And Ilya said, no. And instead of just like letting it go, mm-hmm. Shane asks a clarifying question. Mm-hmm. And that question is that a good thing? Yep. Shane needs to understand, right? Like, how does Ilya actually feel about the yep. fact that he's not talking to his family? Is he good sad? Comment. Is he not? Yeah. Right? Like, so Shane adapts to everyone, but because he has to, but here he adapts because he wants to be there for Ilya in the way that Ilya also needs, just like Ilya is there for Shane, that like how Shane needs.
Shane sort of operates from this place of moral clarity almost. He has this like really consistent ethical framework, what is right, what is wrong, patterns, routines. And I felt like I used to say, oh, he's just like good and pure. Mm-hmm. And while that mm-hmm. might be true, I feel like it's sort of infantilizing. Shane is not naive. Mm-hmm. It's just that he doesn't lead with suspicion. They don't spend that energy calculating, like, what's your deal?
Yeah, that's good.
Here's another thing the show does really well, because Shane, I feel like, forgives very readily when there's a genuine apology. Like, mm-hmm. I'm thinking about the scene when they're in the bathroom after the award. Ilya has essentially ghosted Shane. And then Ilya comes close and Shane just goes. Like, he folds into him. And, yeah. it, I mean, it was pretty sexy, but it wasn't driven entirely by lust. Shane just took his sort of, I want to get back with you, at face value. Mm-hmm. And I see that too in my husband. I don't think it's because they're like more angelic than the average person. I think it's because when they hear the problem named and they feel like there's a genuine apology, it's done.
It's done.
Oh my God, I wish that I had that inherently, because then there's less need for someone to linger in the hurt, and the transgression has been acknowledged. The closure is done.
Right.
Let's move on. And
let's move on.
It's like super, super refreshing.
And when they're texting back, Ilya does like still mad about Vegas. Yeah. And Shane's like, I'm not mad about anything. Like, and right. he really isn't. He's let it go. So yeah. it makes perfect sense. Yeah.
That's a good one. I didn't think yeah. of that one. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I would be mad forever.
Girl, I know.
Anusha, thank you so much for this discussion. I think it's an important one. I hope we did it justice. And I think it's time to move on to our favorite part of the show.
Our moment of sunshine. So this is a very theme-specific moment. So as part of my ADHD, I have this thing called a 3 a.m. alarm. Well, it's actually not 3 a.m. It's 3:10 a.m. And it's like when I wake up to work. So in the throes of college, medical school, residency, I'd wake up to work, because at 3:10, it's the dead of night. And literally everything is quiet. The world is quiet. My brain is quiet. There's no distractions. There's mm-hmm. no expectations. Everything is silent. And my brain works relatively well. I was talking to my husband about this show, and he takes his phone out and he shows me his standard alarms. And on it is the 3:10 alarm. And not that he wakes up every night at 3:10. Sometimes if it's like a really big thing, I'll ask him to just like turn it on too, in case I like snooze mine. But yeah, he's had
that. So your moment of sunshine is waking up at 3:10 and
no.
your husband having the same alarm to help you wake up at 3:10.
My moment of sunshine is that since he's known me, he's had this. on his phone since he's had an iPhone.
That's very sweet.
Sweet, right? Okay. So what's your moment of sunshine?
Well, as you know, our friends get together for a very quick coffee most Fridays. Mm-hmm. It's usually like four or five of us, and we are catching up for the week. It's mm-hmm. gives me the energy and life to last me for the next Friday, right? Like, it just brings me so much joy.
It's so fun when I can come.
As you also know, most mm-hmm. of our friends that we get together with have ADHD.
And I am neurodivergent.
They're all neurodivergent. And I am, according to the rest of you, is the only neurotypical in the group. Well, less than. Man, I wouldn't say I'm completely, right? But so I spend my Friday mornings drinking coffee and trying my best to understand all the conversations that are happening at the same time. Because during breakfast, there are about two or three conversations going on at the same time between four or five people, and it's nonlinear. I can never finish a story. You're literally proving it right now. I cannot, friends, listeners, I cannot get an entire story out in one breath. I can't. I'm not allowed. I actually wonder sometimes if my friends actually know who I am, because they won't let me talk without interruptions. And I love them all so much that I have been accommodating to this version of storytelling for years. They don't know. Do you guys know me at all? Or
so we do know you very well. We know all the things about you. We just don't need to hear it in a straight line.
That's the difference.
But we have digested everything about you deeply in our hearts, and we know you.
But anyway, that's my moment of sunshine. Most Fridays, whenever we can get away, we just do our hour brekkie, get in there, and it's awesome.
I love that.
And nonlinear. Next week on Everyone Deserves Sunshine, we're talking about music.
I'm super excited to talk about this topic and also to hear about your rave situation.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that. So subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.
And if you want to say hi to the girls in the crease, find us on Instagram, Facebook, and Threads at Everyone Deserves Sunshine.
Or email us at everyonedeservessunshine@gmail.com. New episodes drop on Mondays.
See you then.